Thanks for giving me the chance to talk about this. So this is the first time I've ever do this over the net. So I don't know. If you have questions or if something doesn't come across, let me know. So maybe we start with page number one. That's what I have to do, right? I have to tell you to. Is that it?
No, we tell you.
What? Okay, good. Okay, so let me just say the main message of this talk. So there's a thing that is that always struck me, which is that there's one number occurring in two very different places. One is in cosmology, and the other one is in phase transitions. So in phase transitions, so what I wrote down here, this g of r, that's the correlation function. And there's this little parameter eta, which is the anomalous scaling dimension, and that thing is 0.04. And on the other hand, in cosmology, there's the spectrum of the CMB that has been measured with some accuracy now. And again, you find this slight deviation from complete flatness, and again, it's 0.04. And so the point of my talk is to say that this is not a coincidence. So what I'm saying is that there was a phase transition in the beginning of our universe, and the reason why we see this 0.04 in the spectrum is because of this phase transition. That's the point. So the rest of the talk is just trying to convince you that that is true. So if you go to the next slide, just to be clear, what I'm saying is that this thing that we use, that inflation is used for, which is to come up with this number 0.04, I'm saying that can be done with a phase transition. So we don't need inflation. All we need is a phase transition. Okay. So let's go to page three. So what am I thinking about? So you should see this diagram with phase A, phase B. And so there's some weird stuff, which I call phase A, which we don't know what it is. It's some stuff. It's not quarks, it's not electrons, it's not the kind of matter that we know that is our world. Some other stuff. Spins, some model that we don't know. Then there's a phase transition, and that phase transition leads to a phase B, which is our world. So this one is the world where we have electrons, where we have quarks, and where we describe them in a space-time. And what I'm claiming is that this phase transition has an effect, and the effect that it has is the effect we see in the cosmic microwave background. So this transition, when we look back in time, this transition is what we see in the CMB. That's the basic picture. Okay, so let me get some things that we need to know about a phase transition. So this is page four. Are there questions or no? Someone is raising. No, this is just someone drinking. Okay. So what I'm going to describe is the Zurich Kibble mechanism for phase transition, which is the basic mechanism that people use to look at phase transitions. So this epsilon is a parameter that tells me how close I am to the transition temperature TC, and two things happen as I approach the transition. One thing is that the correlation length goes to infinity, so that's the first part there. And the second thing is that the relaxation time increases too. So as I approach the transition, the dynamic timescale of the system becomes larger and larger. So it becomes slower and slower to react. If you go to the next page, to page number five. So there, at some point, when we change this epsilon, which is the parameter that tells me how close I am to the transition, at some point, if that time scale is bigger than this reaction time, the system effectively freezes. So at that point, there's a correlation length. I call it psi zero. And what will happen is, as the result, as you go through the transition, is that you will create domains of size psi zero. So what you end up with is you end up with a bunch of domains. They all have a characteristic size, which is psi zero. And inside these domains, you might have different states, different ground states. So if you think about a spin model, then the orientation of the spins could be one in one of those domains, and it could be the opposite one in another one of those domains. So this is the picture. As we go through the transition, we create these domains of size psi zero, and we create a bunch of them. And what I'm saying is that our universe is one of those domains. That's the point. That's the picture. Okay? So, and now we come to the key step. So what is it that I want to calculate? What I want to calculate is, if you go to page 6, the next step, the crucial step. So inside these domains of psi zero, you still have regions where the spins, say, if we have a spin model, where the spins are not oriented in the way that you would want to have it for the new ground state. So if the new ground state is all down, all spins down, then there are still regions where the spins are pointing up. And you have regions of all sizes which are pointing up. So to create this ground state, this domain of size psi zero, all these spins that are pointing up, they have to flip. Right? So all these black things that I drew in this little cartoon there, they have to flip to form this new ground state in this domain of size psi zero. And here's the claim. The claim is that it's this flipping that creates the spectrum we observe. That's the point. That's the picture. That's what I want to calculate. So what do I need to do? So I need to calculate the spectrum that comes from these black boxes, if you want. That's what I have to say. That's what I have to do, because it's the flipping of these that is leaving a trace in the new ground state, which is our universe being created in this transition. And what I will show is that this spectrum is exactly the right spectrum that we see. That is, it's an almost flat spectrum with the right exponent. So are there questions about the basic physical picture? Because then we dive right into the calculation. Yeah, Lee. So, yeah.
Does the critical exponent depend on the details of the spin system, which is you're using to model the transition?
Yeah, and I'm trying. You are not extremely clear. So, did you ask whether I need details of the spin system?
Yes. Whether the critical exponent depends on the details of the spin system.
It does, but in a very weak way. In a very weak way. So, if you look at the if you open up a textbook on solid-state physics, what you will find is that these exponents, this eta this is the exponent that I denoted by eta, is between 0.03 and 0.06, and for a lot of systems, it's just plain 0.04. So there's a dependence, but it's very weak, which I think is an interesting thing to note. So you don't need to assume a lot about your system to get that exponent.
So I also have a question. So can you explain in some more detail? So I mean, what you do here is simply looking at the order parameter of the transition between a magnetized and an unmagnetized phase. So in the case of the universe, what is the order parameter that you're thinking of, and what is the dynamics that is driving the phase transition, and
Well, so there, yeah. So I mean, there's a bunch of. Those are all good questions. So let me say something about the order parameter. So the this whole line of reasoning comes from my way of thinking about quantum gravity. So I thought that I always had the idea that quantum gravity should be actually an emergent thing. And if you believe that, then you have two paths to go. Either you're looking for a massless spin 2 particle, just like a phonon or a photon is an emergent particle in some spin models, you would look for a massless spin 2 particle in some more complicated spin model, and that would be one way. But I always thought that maybe this is not the right way to go. Maybe the place to put it is not in some perturbative field theory, but it's a more non-perturbative feature of the vacuum itself. So I try to argue that it's the order parameter that the non-perturbative variation of the order parameter that gives you gravity. So in my case, what I try to argue is that if you have just a spin model and the order parameter is some scalar field, then I would identify the scalar field with just the Newtonian potential. And this would work in this case. But the point for this talk, what I don't want to make that strong statement. I just want to point out that I would get that spectrum, the one that we observe, and then you can take different attitudes towards it. And I will discuss this at the end. So for me, this whole thing is a guide to quantum gravity. Whatever you do, whatever your quantum theory does, you have to somehow figure out a way to make this connection to. You have to somehow figure out a way to find a phase transition in your theory, and then you have to whatever degrees of freedom you had before this transition, you have to somehow find a way to combine them in such a way that they give you this order parameter that has this behavior. So, do you is that clear? Is that so? I don't want to make a strong point. So I will make it at the end for myself. But I think this could be used for more than that. I mean, even if you're doing loop quantum gravity or you're doing spin foams or something like that, I think what you should try to do is you should try to identify whatever it is that has this behavior in your model. And if you do, then this thing can give you this thing, this spectrum that you thought you need inflation for. So that's the first point. The second point that you ask is, you're talking about changing temperature, so what's the outside setup? is there someone dialing something or? And basically, I'm agnostic about that for now. So, God knows, our universe is a drop, is a grain of salt, is I don't care. There's just something changing. There's some reason why there's a phase transition, whatever reason it is. Okay. it's very weird because I can't tell whether my answer. Usually, I just look at people and you know whether the answer made sense or not. Like that, I just see like these blobs, and I can't tell. So you have to tell me.
No, the answer made sense.
Okay. Okay. Any more questions? Okay. Great. So that was the basic setup. And now let's calculate the spectrum. And this is reasonably straightforward, except for one step, which I will point out. So now we're on page 7. Is that clear of that? So I take the basic formula for the spectrum. So it's this the first line there on the slide. And this theta is the order parameter, and theta v is the order parameter restricted to some volume, and then you take the large volume limit of that. so that this whole expression makes sense. So what I do is I write down theta as this sum over thetas for one theta, which is basically a step function for each one of these regions that have to flip. Right, so this capital I is the set of regions that need to flip, and I write the theta as that thing. And what I'm interested in is the square of the Fourier transform, and I get this expression that which is the last one on the bottom. And I'm using so there would be these diagonal terms, but they cancel because I'm only looking at the average. So the if you go to the next page, page 8. I'm introducing now a key quantity, which is this mu of L. So this mu of L is telling me about the number of regions in the volume V that have a scale, that have a size of between L and L plus DL. Right? So this V times mu times DL is the number of regions in the volume V of size L, which is between little l and little l plus dl. So if I use that definition, if I use this function nu, I can write the spectrum in this integral expression that's at the bottom of this page. So the thing that I have to do is I have to calculate two quantities. I have to calculate the nu, and I have to calculate this Fourier transform for one region. Okay, so let's start with with the number of regions, and the number of regions, one can do a nice scaling argument to get this number nu. So the first formula on this next page, on page 9, is what is it saying? What it's saying is, imagine that you're at a critical configuration. I denoted this critical configuration with this curly bracket and the S in there. So if it spins, then this is a set of spins. If S is a critical configuration and you do one renormalization group transformation on this critical configuration, you again end up with a critical configuration, which means that this number of regions of size L evaluated on these critical configurations will be the same. So I will get the same number of regions whether if I apply R or if I don't apply R. Right, that's the key starting point that allows me to calculate this. So now let's think about what this renormalization group transformation actually does. So you can think of this R as doing two things. So first, you look at some block, say 3x3 spins or something like that. And you have some rule that tells you what is the majority, and you replace all spins with that majority spin that you find. So in this cartoon that I drew there, you replace the two black ones with the white one, and you get just a plain white thing. And then the next step is you take this whole block of 9 spins and you replace it by one. Right. So this is a very simple way of thinking about renormalization group transformation, just a plain block sprint transformation. But let's see what happens in these two steps individually. So the first step doesn't change the nu. And the reason is that if you're in a large region, right, if you're in a large region, which is much larger than the letter scale, this majority rule, this averaging thing that you're doing, doesn't do anything because most of the blocks are inside one colored region, right? If you have a big blob of some white stuff, say already the ground state, and you are in here and you do this averaging procedure, you don't change anything because it's already white, right? So the first part doesn't do anything, and the second part is a rescaling. And the rescaling, if you go to page 10, so the rescaling looks like this. So this is a bit, So I'm looking at this lambda. So this lambda would be 3 if we replace a block of 3x3 spins by just one spin. So this lambda would be 3, but let's just stick it, let's just keep it general, just any lambda will do. So the lambda inside the nu that's multiplying L is because if we rescale it, then we are asking for regions that came from the larger part. Right? So we're rescaling the whole thing, so things get smaller. So if you ask for some L, then that came from a much larger part before the rescaling. The lambda multiplying the nu in front of it is because there's this dl in the definition of the nu, and the lambda d is from the dimension of the lattice, right? If you rescale the whole thing, then you get in a volume you just get more volumes that you have to look at. So what you get is you get this lambda to the d plus 1 in front of it, and you get the lambda l in the argument. And if you assume that nu of l is a power law, then this equation gives you that nu of l goes like l to the minus d minus 1. Right? That's the key thing. And the minus 1 was actually, I think I got some gray hair because of the minus 1. I forgot the dl part for like a week or something. Okay. Okay, now we come to one crucial part. So this is great, and we will see that this alone gives us the flat spectrum. But we can do better. So let's go to the next page, 11, and now let's discuss what effect there is because of the existence of a small length scale. So let's look at the correlation function. So the correlation function has this behavior, r to the minus d plus 2, and then there's a minus eta there, this which is ultimately 0.04. So why is there this eta? So the eta is the one sign that is left that the system is not truly scale invariant. There's another length scale, which in solid state systems is the lattice spacing. So what does it mean? It means that if you think about it, the correlation, if you go below the lattice spacing, is perfect, right? If you, there's just this one spin, it's perfectly correlated to itself, right? So what you have is you have slightly more correlation at smaller length scales, and the reason is that there is this fundamental scale, which is the lattice spacing. And the same goes for this quantity that we just calculated, which is this nu of L. So there, the thing is different. So you have no region that are smaller than the lattice spacing, which means that you should have slightly fewer regions as you go to small length scales. So instead of the minus eta there, you get a plus eta. And if you think about it, these two observations about the correlation function and about these regions is consistent because you need, if you want more correlation, you need fewer regions because the more regions you have, the more cancellations you have. Right. This is, so the fewer regions you have, the more correlation there is. So this is the form that we need, which is the minus L minus D minus 1 plus eta. And I'm in the paper, I'm giving a bit more of a detailed argument for why this is true, but let's just stick with this for now. So this was the first part. So in this formula that I had in the beginning, there were two parts. One is the number of regions, which is this nu of L, and the other thing is the contribution from one region, right? So that's the next thing we have to calculate, and that actually turns out to be quite simple. So if you go to page 12, so I'm just going to use Parseval's identity for that. So imagine, so this the first line is, so I'm assuming that the value of the order parameter inside one of these regions that it has to flip is just, say, one. It's just one value, whatever it is, right? It's up, corresponding to some value that I don't care what it is. It's just some value. So then if I want to calculate this integral, then I get this L3, which is the size of the region, that's how big it is, times whatever the value of this order parameter is squared. And that, according to Parseval's identity, is the same as if I were to calculate this for the Fourier transform. So for the Fourier transform, the size of the region is now 1 over L cubed. And I get this, the Fourier transform squared part there. And that allows me to calculate what the quantity that I want to calculate. And I get this expression at the bottom, which has this L to the 6 part. Right. So I mean, the point is that if you have some size thing like this, this is the L thing, then the Fourier transform will be 1 over that. The support of the Fourier transform will be 1 over that. But Parseval's identity tells me, well, how big the other signal has to be. And that gives me this Fourier transform that I need for my formula. So now we have all the ingredients. So the formula, which was on page God knows what, so it had two things. One was the number of regions, and the other thing was this, the contribution from one region, and we just plug it in now. So if you go to page 13, you get the spectrum, and I just plug it in. So this integral is now cut off at 1 over k, and that comes from this contribution from the calculation that we did before, because only length scales that are smaller than 1 over k contribute. For the rest, we get 0. And then we get minus 4, because we're in three dimensions, plus this very crucial eta, and then we get the L to the 6 from the contribution from one region. And if you calculate this, you get k to the 3 times this 1 over k to the 3 plus eta, and you get exactly the spectrum that we want. And I wrote there, identify theta, the order parameter, with the potential phi, and you get exactly the spectrum that you want. Okay, so let's discuss this. So the point is, of course, if you go to page 14, the main points that I want to make are, the first one is that what I'm trying to argue is that there was a phase transition in the early history of our universe. That's the main point. The second point is the tilt of the spectrum that we observe in the CMB is a sign that there's a small length scale in nature that we haven't observed in any other way yet. And the third one is that gravity is emergent. So let's talk about this in a bit more detail, these points. So let's go to page 15, and let's talk about inflation for a second, because this is what I'm saying can be replaced by just a plain phase transition. So the first thing is that this is much more economical. Well, it's economical in one way, right? So so the first thing is that there's no inflaton. So I don't need to introduce a new particle that does the job of producing inflation for me. That's the first thing. And then I don't have to introduce a potential with this low roll parameters chosen just so that I get the 0.04. So there's no fine tuning involved. And what I think is much more important than that now is that in recent years it has become clear that inflation is not just this nice theory. That inflation has baggage. But there are all these things that you get that you don't want when inflation is around. And the way Guth puts it is that he says everything that can happen has happened an infinite number of times, which is a terrible situation for physics to be in, right? So you end if you believe in inflation, then you have to think about all these ugly things of, well, how do you do physics in a situation like that, where essentially there's no predictive power? You have to think about some measure on the space of all possible universes, and you have to try to somehow, say, find this measure in a way that still allows you to make some sort of predictions. And it's a terrible situation, really. So if you buy this phase transition picture, you don't end up in this, right? You don't have a choice. There's nothing to choose. There's no particle. There's no potential. There's no none of this. All things are possible. All possible things are happening. So that's the point about inflation. Then let's talk about quantum gravity. And I already said this before. Oh yes, please.
Just a comment. It's worse than that, because you don't get the 0.04 either, because there's an infinite number of universes where the eight is 0.04.
I understood the first part. I didn't understand the last part.
There's an infinite. This is a point that Paul Steinhardt makes. There's an infinite number of universes where the scaling is 0.04, as predicted, but there's an infinite number of universes where it's not.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. That's the point. I mean, that's right. So that's the thing that yes, inflation can produce the universe that looks like our universe, but it can produce all sorts of other universes that look nothing like our universe. And if you buy the whole story, it does produce them. Right? Exactly. And this 0.04 is just happens to be in one part, one tiny set of universes. And it's nowhere, yeah, it's completely unclear as far as I understand. You can't say, well, it's most of them or anything like that. If you could say that, then you could say, man, it's not great, but it still works. But apparently you can't say that, right? There's no way to put a nice measure on it to say, to say that our universe is somehow special or singled out or something like that. Yeah. So the situation for inflation is kind of, I don't know, it's kind of unpleasant, right? It's kind of, on the one hand, yes, it's been doing these predictions, it's kind of great, but on the other hand, you buy a lot of stuff that you don't want. Right, all these universes that look nothing like ours, and that they have to be there, blah blah blah, all this stuff is terrible. Okay, no more question on that. Okay, so then let me make some remarks on quantum gravity, because I think that this is an important thing. So I think the way I see it, there are three possibilities. Either this is just pure numerology. Right, it's just 0.04 just happened to have occurred in two places, and somehow I completely don't believe that. Right, so you would have to believe that there's a completely normal physical thing that happens in labs all over the world all the time, which is a phase transition, which gives you naturally this number 0.04. And that nature came up with another way of doing it, which requires you to introduce a new field, a fine-tuned potential, and all this stuff, which is very complicated, just to produce the same number again, right? So you would have to believe that nature chose to do the same thing in two different ways, one very complicated, one very simple, and I just don't believe that. But it's a possibility, right? That it's that's one. The second possibility is, so what I'm now talking about is what I'm thinking is there was a phase transition. Our universe is emerging from some stuff that we don't know. But there are two possibilities now. One possibility is that this transition that we are looking at is a transition that could be of the kind where you have some quantum spin foamy loop quantum gravity kind of stuff before the transition, and the transition we are looking at is the one that produced the smooth manifold kind of thing that we're looking at now, right? So this would be, it would be kind of a nice kind of emergence, because the degrees of freedom that you describe, that our universe now, were already there before, right? Because in all of loop quantum gravity or spin foams, the kind of degrees of freedom you're dealing with are basically small spacetimes, right? I mean, you have like tetrahedra or loop quantum gravity, you have some variables that are related to the geometry of spacetime, which makes sense in the smooth part, but it's not clear what they do there. So what you're doing is you're saying, okay, we have some stuff which is basically small Planck-scale versions of spacetime, and they arrange themselves to form a smooth spacetime, and the effect of this arrangement is what we see in the CMB. That's a possibility, and it's sort of emergence light, right? It's not real emergence, because you're using the same labels that you have in the emergent phase used to describe the phase that the stuff emerged from. It's a possibility. What I think is what I think is much more likely is that we're looking at true emergence, meaning that the degrees of freedom that are in the phase prior to our phase have nothing to do with what we see now. Meaning that if you want to describe that physics, you shouldn't start by taking what we know now and make sort of small quantum versions of it and hope that this will describe this transition correctly. So my idea is that what this is a strong indication of is that we're looking at this point number three, that there was a real event of emergence in our universe. The stuff that gave rise to this emergence, this underlying stuff, we have no idea what it is. And we should probably not think it's small Planck scale sized versions of stuff that we know on our side. But I don't know, I mean, if you are doing quantum gravity or spin foams or CDT, or which all have this feature that they're basically small versions of space-time stuck together, so they're small versions of what we have now, then you can argue, well, okay, that's still possible. It's just that what's happening is that these quantum foamy things arrange themselves to form this classical space-time that that we look at now, and the effect of this formation of this classical space-time is the spectrum that we see. And that's a possibility. But my preference is point three, real emergence. Okay. So then I think, right, I just wanted to point out that on page 17, I think this it's pretty cool. The fact that there's a chance that we actually seen actual discreteness, or at least the presence of a new length scale. And we've seen it in the CMB. I think this is a very cool possibility that I think is kind of exciting. That, I mean, this 0.04, if you take it seriously, what it says is A, phase transition, and B, discreteness. Which I think is cool. I think this is a cool thing. Right. And then just let me finish with this last slide of number 18. So I think that there's new physics in this intersection of GR, cosmology, quantum field theory, and the point that not a lot of people might want to put there is condensed matter physics, right? Which is the whole point, right? Everything I've been saying is making the point that actually plays a role, right? All these tools, correlation functions, and this eta and blah blah, it all comes from condensed matter physics. All right, I guess I was very fast, but so that's that. Yes, please.
Questions or comments? So let me start with the numerology part. So if we take this idea seriously, that then what you're saying is that from the tilt of the CMB spectrum, we can read off what the symmetry group of our order parameter that describes emergent emergent phase of spacetime is should be. So do you know how accurately we can at this point distinguish the different choices for the symmetry groups and what is the future
prospects? Yeah, I think that this eta parameter is a very bad way of learning a lot about the underlying theory. That a lot of it's not distinguishing well between the possibilities.
So
which I think is the strength of this thing, but it's kind of, I mean, what I see what you want to do. I mean, you would like to be able to take that and then say, well, then the underlying stuff has to be this or that, something, I don't know, whatever, some group, some, and it looks to me that is not very that. It's not very strong, the dependence of this eta on the underlying stuff. So I think that's not going to fly.
So I would imagine that different microscopic models should also show up in different parameters, not only in the eta. Do you have any other ideas what data depend on the precise?
Yeah, good question. Good question. There are parameters which are much more dependent on the underlying thing. And I haven't thought about using them. Yeah, that's a good point.
There is the amplitude, right? The amplitude of fluctuations. But you also have.
I didn't understand a word.
You need the amplitude of the fluctuations, in addition to.
Yeah, so the amplitude. I was thinking about that. So the amplitude should be. I mean, it should be naturally small, right? But since I'm still kind of vague on so. I mean, what I said was, so you have this flipping, and I'm saying it's that process which leaves an imprint on the ground state, right? But if you looked at it, I didn't give you the actual mechanism, right? I didn't tell you. So if you look at the formulae when I write them, there's always this wiggly sign, right? I don't actually put the amplitude there. And the thing is that I'm not sure what the mechanism. So I don't know how to calculate that amplitude yet.
But Olaf, even if you don't know the mechanism, you know that there's a small number involved, which is 10 to the minus 5th.
It should be small. Yeah, it should be naturally small because most people will just neglect it, right? Most people just don't care about that at all.
But
it should be small. I mean, it's clearly small.
No, but
I would like to know why it's 10 to the minus 5, and this 10 to the minus 5 could depend on things like TC or something like that, right?
But it suggests that there's a ratio of scales, and it suggests.
Sorry, yeah. So I didn't get.
It's in inflation and in other things like inflation, the 10 to the minus 5th is the ratio of the scale at which the inflation is happening to the Planck scale.
Right.
And that suggests that maybe in your mechanism, the Planck scale has
Sorry.
To happen because you make space-time.
You are very hard, so I always understand like half a sentence. Sorry.
That's okay. Let me ask a different question. Very, very short question. If you get rid of inflation, you have to solve the horizon problem a different way.
Yeah. So you're right. So I should have actually said this. So I think there are two things to say. So one is the horizon problem arises because you have the Big Bang, right? You realize that if you follow follow the right light rays, you see that there was no way for the things at the surface of last scattering to have interacted, to have been in causal contact. So if you don't have a Big Bang, you can't make the same argument immediately. So that's the first point. The second point is you can make the correlation as large as you want because, I mean, there's all this time before the transition that you don't know anything about. So basically, if you there's a free parameter, if you want, which is the speed with which you go through the transition. If you're infinitely slow, you can make the correlation as big as you want. So there are ways to deal with the horizon problem in a very natural way in this setup.
And what about the flatness problem?
Sorry, I didn't get it.
The flatness problem.
Say again? The flatness problem. Well, yeah, so the flatness problem, I would say, I mean, if you are in a proper lattice model, say you actually have like a spin model a la Wen or something like that, then I think the flatness problem would be just that you have a lattice. That's it. Done. And the question then would be, well, that's great, but can you say something about gravity, right? Which you would have to do. And that's, I think I can, but that's a bit involved. So there's another point. So since we're going through the list, so the other problem would be the monopole question, right? Would that have been next?
Yes.
Right. So if you look at I started by describing this Zurich Kibble picture for phase transitions. And what they say is that these monopoles would appear at the intersection of these domains. You remember this first picture of the domains of size Xi zero. So the monopoles would appear where these things touch each other, the domains of size Xi zero. Which means that since our universe would be one of those domains, that these defects would not be inside our universe, but they would be at the boundary. And I think we're fine with that, right? There would be one defect per, one monopole per universe. So I think that's okay. I think that's okay.
I can't tell
whether that arrived or not.
I have a comment on your very last slide, which was about whether there's true emergence or what you characterized as not true emergence. I mean, this word emergence is used all the time for many different things now.
So right.
I'm not sure whether the word is in itself misleading, but it seems to me that you're suggesting the real emergence is something more different than any of the things you listed up above, causal sets, CDT, spin foams.
Yeah, so
I don't see that as reasonable, and I don't see that history. So I want to make three points. First, it seems to me historically that's not the way things have ever gone. Second of all, I don't think it's reasonable that we can hope for something entirely different. How would we even think of it? And third of all, I don't think that your example is, I think what you're talking about is less emergent than the other thing, because you're taking for granted some sort of Galilean space-time almost, and ordinary time.
So these
space-time aspects, these things which constitute space-time, are far from emergent in this sense. And the reason I don't think that's an accident, I think, how will we think of something that has nothing in common with what we already know? I mean, probably the historical prime example of emergence was atomic theory. And people...
You say what?
The theory, atoms, the idea of atoms.
Okay.
The idea that fluids and so on emerge, things that appear continuous to us on large scales, all kinds of events, you know, that are not directly atomic in nature, emerge from this underlying atomic structure. And this was a hypothesis that took 1,000 years to verify, something or more. But the thing that was postulated as the substructure was not something totally different. It was a kind of a model of a small object of the sort that we know. It seems to me that without some sort of conceptual bridge between the things we already know and the thing you're postulating as the substructure, we're completely at sea. I mean, someone might dream up something. It's not logically impossible.
But how are we to proceed in that direction? So I'm sort of questioning your contrast between two and three.
Let me make a comment. I think I feel very strongly about that exact point. So I think that all this list that I made there of lukewarm gravity spin foams and something like that came basically about because people were thinking about quantizing classical GR. Right? So the point then is that the objects that you end up with, if you quantize something, they carry labels which come from the classical theory. Right? So the interpretation of all the objects in these theories are little space-timey things, like Planck scale versions of space-time stuff. I call that sort of weak emergence, because what you're trying to make emerge is already part of the label of the theory that you're starting out with. And I don't find that interesting.
Does that apply to causal sets?
Well, I think that is sort of borderline. I mean, I think you can make a case that in its purest form, you guys are outside what I just said. But that only applies to the purest form, because if you actually listen to the way you guys talk about it, it's very clear, very fast, that you have very clear ideas what these lines are and how they're basically how they relate to space-time things. So you introduce these notions very fast too, but in its purest form, I would say yes, you can sort of say no, you're fine. But I think the other ones are clearly like that. And so let me say that. I mean, if you think about a spin model or something like the simple Ising model, the what you have is you have like all these little Ising spins interacting with each other, and what they do is after the phase transition, they create this one big spin which is pointing up or down or something like that, right? So the thing that you're trying to make emerge looks just like a big version of the small things that the thing emerged from, right? The big emergent part,
right,
is the model for the small things, right? So when you write down the model, you take the big thing and you just make a lot of, you make it very small and you make a lot of them, and that's your model. So the model already has built in the thing that you want to get at. And I think that all these quantum gravity models are just like that. So they're not spins, but they're space-timey things, but they're basically like that. And I think that this is it's basically a textbook thing. It would be very weird if nature would be just like that. You know, this the simplest textbook thing, which we did because we didn't know what else to write or something. So what I'm looking at is systems like I don't know what Zhao Gang is writing down, where you have spins, but the thing that emerges from that is very different from spins. Right, so you have some model which has spins and some weird interaction between them, and what you end up with is QED. Right, so the thing that emerges has nothing to do with the degrees of freedom that are underlying it. It's not spinny, right? It's not that it's electrons and photons and that's it. So I think that's the interesting kind of emergence that is what I'm after. I mean, you can, as I said, right? This is my preference. I think that it makes sense. It's a key concept, and it's still kind of badly understood, and I don't know, but I think it's a key concept, and I would be very surprised if our fundamental theory would be of this textbook little space-timey thingies kind of variety.
I don't agree that that has nothing to do, what emerges there has nothing to do with the underlying structure.
Sorry.
I disagree that what emerges in this spin net what are they called, string net models has nothing to do with the underlying structure. It has,
well, nothing, of course, not.
A lot in common.
No, nothing, of course, it doesn't.
You have sort of three categories. One was start from the Einstein equations, apply the rules of quantization to them, and produce something. That would be the least emergent in your sense of the word.
Right.
And to a certain extent, loop quantum gravity is like that. Spin foams are like that to a certain extent. CDTs are like that to a certain extent. I don't think causal sets are like that. The second category is that something about the fundamental structure that you're postulating is in common with something about the structure, the emergent, so-called emergent structure. And the third category, which I think is empty, I don't know of any example, is that there's nothing in common between the fundamental degrees of freedom and the structures you're postulating and space-time, or which is in this case meant to be the emergent structure. So in all of these examples, there's quite a lot in common. And certainly in these condensed matter models, there's a huge amount in common. I mean, space and time itself, which is the thing that you're trying to get as an emergent object, is completely the same in these emergent, in these condensed matter models as it is. The only thing that might change is the metric, which is a particular field, might have a different signature if you're lucky, or it might have some Lorentzian nature or something like that. But you retain the huge amount of structure, more, I think, than in some of these other models. I'm not saying it's not an interesting...
There's two points. So I think that...
But I don't think it escapes from the need to have something in common. Important.
No, I mean,
deeper structure.
No, I think it's... So if you look at the big examples where emergence has been observed, and I don't know, the Hall effect, the quantized Hall effect, the fractional Hall effect, and all these things, it is kind of surprising, right? I mean, the new degrees of freedoms that you have to describe the system are very different from the stuff that you started out with. But of course, it is coming from the stuff, from the underlying stuff, right? It is, of course, it's one system. It's not like there's no connection between the two. It's just that it's a very different description. And the second thing about this particular point about gravity is one where the point for me is this, that there's a theory of quantum gravity that we haven't found yet. That's the point. So this, which is of course a weak point to make, right, to counter your argument. But what I'm saying is that you're saying, well, it uses all the structure that is already there, the Galilean space-time or something like that. And so, what are you doing? It's a terrible example of emergence. What I'm saying is that no, there's another theory out there. We don't know what it is, but it's there. And it's the space-time that would be in the emergent phase would be not so simple as the Galilean space-time that the system is embedded in.
Well, how would you
imagine this? I tried to argue for that. I called this internal relativity. It wasn't, I mean, so I can show you how you get Newtonian gravity from that, but it's not very well thought out. It's not, so what I'm saying is that I think this is one should take this seriously, and one should look for gravity in a different place.
So I think we're running out of time a little bit, so maybe we can close the general discussion. And if you don't hang up, Olaf, then you can continue the discussion after this. But first, let's thank Olaf again for his talk.